For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, well, one of the cool things about studying a chapter like this is that you get to kind of a survey of, to learn the storyline of the Bible. And the pieces make sense because they're part of a story. You know, you can't just take a little tiny chunk of a story out and have it make sense. It makes sense in light of where it fits in. So we're studying kind of a survey of the OT here. These patriarchs begins with Isaac. That's the miracle baby that God promised Abraham and Sarah. And we read that by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. Okay, this is referring to an event later in his life when he was near the end of his life. But so not much is said about him here. Actually, not much is said in the OT about Isaac either. It mostly talks about his parents, his wife, or his sons. He kind of is, you know, really doesn't have much to say about him at all. He must have been a man of faith, and the proof of that is what the author of Hebrews is referring to here, but he's definitely way down from the level of Abraham. He's not on that level at all. And this is what we'll see as we go through the patriarchs, is that things are going down, 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 until we finally hit this amazing dude named Joseph. And he takes it back up to an incredible level again. His wife is a liar. She's a cheater, manipulator, and doesn't seem to have much moral quality. Anyway, she's teaching her son how to lie, encouraging him to lie and cheat. Esau, thick-headed, unspiritual, hunter, marrying Canaanite women, never says anything spiritual, never talks about God or anything like that. Jacob, also a liar and a cheater, and as I said, he was getting discipled into that. Both Isaac and his wife practiced favoritism. To Isaac, his favorite son was Esau, the hunter. To Rebecca, her favorite son was Jacob, the cook. And, you know, that's ungodly. I mean, when your parents of children to favor one over the other is harmful to the kids because it sets up a stage for jealousy and infighting. And it's unbiblical because they're both made in the image of God. I mean, it's just wrong. So I think Isaac has to take a major part of the blame for this dysfunctional family. You know, one son has to flee the country to keep from getting murdered by the other son. And it's just, it's a terrible picture. And yet, he must have had some connection and still to God, because in this, where he gave his blessing to Jacob and to Esau, he accurately predicted the future of the descendants that would turn into two countries. Esau became the country of Edom, and Jacob became the country of Israel. And he predicted that Edom would become subservient to Israel, which did happen. And so God was still working with him. Next came Jacob, the guy who, as we pointed out, had been discipled into being a liar by his mom. And also very confused ideas about God when he has a vision of the stairway to heaven. He doesn't interpret it rightly, doesn't know what it means. He thinks that there's something magical about the place that he's in, where he happened to be sleeping. When he goes to Aram and serves this Laban guy for 14 years, he's superstitious. He thinks that he tries to practice sympathetic magic by making sticks striped and dotted and putting those in front of the feed troughs for the sheep. He thinks that makes more spotted and striped sheep come out. And since he had a deal where Laban got the white sheep and the black sheep, and he got the mixed sheep, he thought that was making the sheep multiply this way. It was actually God. Had nothing to do with his stupid sticks. God was gracious to him, though. Revealed himself. There was the wrestling match they had at Peniel on the way back, when he was scared of his brother Isaac, who was going to come out to murder him because he was riding out with 400 men. It turned out not to happen. He also practiced favoritism with his kids. He also practiced polygamy, which usually leads to trouble. He had two wives. He favored one, Rachel, the one he really wanted, Leah, the one he got stuck with. And Leah, though, is way more fertile. So she has 10 sons, Rachel, 2 sons, and she died in birth, childbirth with a second son. And Jacob loved the sons of the woman who he loved more. And so that sets up a lot of the dysfunction that goes on in this family. These 10 no good sons, we go through chapters, whole chapters, where it describes their murdering, incest, intermarriage with the Canaanites, and just, you know, real depraved stuff. And it's all showing us the sinking action that's going on here. They're completely worthless. And of course, what they do to Joseph and everything else. Jacob probably has to get some credit for the spirituality of Joseph. Somebody must have told him about the ways of God. Wasn't his mother, because she died when he was still really young. Must have been Jacob, knew enough about God to raise, you know, a pretty amazing dude. And that's the dude we're going to focus on tonight. This, by the way, in Proverbs, or in Hebrews 11 here, he's pointing to a time when he went through and blessed his sons. And also, again, accurate predictive prophecy, including a prophecy about Jesus, about Christ, that the scepter, the royal scepter, would not depart from the tribe of Judah until Shiloh comes. And the theologians have analyzed that this is a reference to the Messiah. Anyway, and it was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, confidently spoke about God's bringing the people of Israel out of Egypt. He was so sure of it that he commanded them to carry his bones with them when they left. So for each of these guys, our author has gone directly to the end of their life, showing that they were in there with God at this stage in their life. And he really doesn't, you know, tell the actual stories. But I felt like with Joseph, it's such an amazing story. I'd like to zoom in on this guy a little bit and try to read through some of this story. We can't read the whole thing. It's 7 chapters long. So I picked out, I think we get the story flow with the stuff that we're going to read. Story starts out telling us that he is Jacob's favorite son. And he also has this profile that emerges. He's super sharp. Real smart, good looking, built, and he's cut, he's a hunk. Everywhere he goes, he's charismatic, people want to follow him, people just sense this guy belongs in leadership. He always rises to the top of any scene that he's a part of. So he's spiritually gifted too, he can interpret dreams, he can get prophetic visions. And yet, he lives this incredibly miserable life of confusion and pain. Let's read through this. Start in 37, too. This is the history of Jacob's family. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flocks with his half-brothers. And at one point, he went and reported to his father some of the bad things his brothers were doing. I mean, they were rank. Probably, they were. Some of them were rapists. They killed. The incest. All of those. God knows what he saw, but he went back and ratted them out. And that really pissed him off. And so they said they hated him for that reason. And we read that Jacob loved Joseph more than any other of his children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So one day he gave Joseph a special gift, a beautiful robe. This is the shirt of many colors. Loomed, very expensive piece in that world, man, where people had to hand make cloth. But his brothers hated Joseph because of their father's partiality. They could not say a kind word to him. One night, Joseph had a dream, and he promptly reported the details to his brothers, causing them to hate him even more. "Hey, listen to this dream," he announced. "We were out in the field tying up bundles of grain. My bundle stood up, and then you guys' bundles all gathered around that and bowed low before it." That's great. "Oh, so you're going to be our king, are you?" And they hated him all the more because of the dream and what he had said. Not too smart to be rubbing up in their face with this dream. Then Joseph had another dream, and this time he told his brothers about it. He says, "Listen to this dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed low before me." And this time he told his father as well. as his brothers. And his father rebuked him. What do you know? Oh, so yeah, your mother and I and everyone, all your brothers are going to bow before you, think you're going to be our king. Shut up. Well, not too smart, really. Although it turns out these dreams are prophetic. Do you have to go and throw it up in people's face? Probably not too smart, not diplomatic. One time then later, it says that his dad sent him up to Shechem, where his brothers had the flocks, to check in on how things were going. Long three days hike up there. And as he's coming up, they recognized him. Look, here he comes. Let's get him. We'll kill him. They say, here comes that dreamer. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into the deep pit. Then we can tell our father that a wild animal's eaten him, and we'll see what becomes of all these dreams of his. Well, Reuben came to Joseph's rescue. He says, let's not kill it. He says, why should we shed his blood? Let's just throw him alive into this pit. It's a cistern. These are deep, like 20 feet deep, bowl-shaped things lined, you know, that are plastered around the side to hold water. You can't get out of them at all. It would be definitely a death sentence. We'll just throw him down in there. That way he can die without our having to touch him. Real phony distancing from the action here. So when Joseph arrived, they pulled off his beautiful robe, and then they threw him into the pit. This pit was normally used to store water, but it was empty at the time. Well, they sit down to eat and going to have some lunch. And then look over and notice a caravan of camels in the distance coming toward them. It was a group of Ishmaelite traders taking spices, balm, and myrrh from Gilead down to Egypt. And so Judah said to the others, what can we really gain by killing our brother? That would just give us a guilty conscience. Let's just sell him to the Israelite traders. Then we won't be responsible for his death. After all, he is our brother. We wouldn't want to do anything bad to our brother. We'd just sell another slave. And the brothers agreed. That way they got some money out of it too. Well, they took the coat of many colors, the cloak. They dipped it in blood, probably shredded it a little bit. And they go walking back home and bring it to the dad. And ask him, "Is this? We found this in the field," they told him. It's Joseph's robe, isn't it? Well, Jacob, the father, recognized it at once. Oh, yeah, my son's robe, a wild animal has attacked and eaten him. Surely Joseph has been torn to pieces. And Jacob tore his clothes, which is an Mideastern sign of mourning, and put on sackcloth, and he mourned deeply for his son for many days. Well, 39, meanwhile. Joseph is now a slave, goes down on the caravan down to Egypt. When he arrived there, he was purchased by Potiphar, a member of the personal staff of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Potiphar was the captain of the palace guard, so this guy is aristocracy. He's one of the, you know, inner circle of the top, richest, most powerful people in the world. The Egyptian empire was massive at this time in history, dwarfing any other power in the ancient world, in the Western world. Well, the Lord was with Joseph, though, and blessed him greatly as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this, and he realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything he did. And so Joseph naturally became quite a favorite with him. Potiphar soon put Joseph in charge of his entire household, and he entrusted him with all of his business dealings. He's made him the household steward, a common practice where you have a top, you know, servant who keeps the books and basically disperses money. They have extreme trust from their owner, doesn't even worry about the cash or anything like that. It's all under this steward, and Joseph becomes that leader. Well, Joseph, we read, was very handsome and a well-built young man. I told you, he was a hunk. And about this time, Potiphar's wife began to desire him and invited him to sleep with her. Her pickup line was, "Lie with me." Direct approach. But Joseph refused. Look, he told her, my master trusts me with everything in his entire household. No one here has more authority than I do. He's held back nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How could I ever do such a wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God. We see that he's really still motivated by his faith in God. And he refuses. You know, he could have probably said yes and gained even more, you know, power and influence in this situation, but wouldn't do it. But she kept coming back at him day after day, but he refused to sleep with her. And he kept out of her way as much as possible. But one day, however, no one else was around when he was doing his work inside the house. She came up and seized him, grabbed him by his shirt, demanding, lie with me. Joseph tore himself away, but as he did, his shirt came off. She won't let go, and finally he just pulls himself out, runs away, and she's left holding his shirt in her hands. When she saw that she had his shirt and that he had fled, she was pissed. Beware the wrath of a woman scorned. She began screaming. Soon all the men around the palace came running. My husband has brought this Hebrew slave here to insult us, she sobbed. He tried to rape me, but I screamed. And when he heard my loud cries, he ran, and look, he left his shirt here. Here's the evidence. After hearing his wife's story, Potiphar was furious. He retold the whole story. And he took Joseph and threw him into the prison where the king's prisoners were held. Kind of surprising, quite surprising, really, that instead of killing him for trying to rape his wife, that Potiphar would just throw him in jail. Just guessing here. Potiphar certainly liked Joseph. We were told that. I'm sure he asked him, is this true? And Joseph's like, she's been trying to sleep with me, and I've been saying no. And I think Potiphar probably suspected that his old lady was messing around. That's the only thing that would account for such a lenient sentence here, in my mind. The Lord was with Joseph in the prison. And he granted Joseph favor with the chief jailer. Before long, the jailer put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and over everything that happened in the prison. Little pattern here. The chief jailer had no more worries after that because Joseph just took care of everything. The Lord was with him, making everything run smoothly and successfully. Of course, he is still in a dungeon here, so it's not that great. Chapter 40. Sometime later, Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and chief baker offended him, and he threw them both in jail where Joseph was, in the palace of Potiphar, the captain of the guard. Okay. They both have a dream. I'm gonna fast forward here. They both have dreams, and they both come to Joseph saying, we heard you can interpret dreams. He's like, yeah. So the baker's dream is bad news. He's like, you're going to be taken out in a few days and hung and die. And he did. The other guy, though, the butler, the cupbearer for Pharaoh, his dream predicted that in a few days he would be recalled and reinstated into his old position with Pharaoh. And that happened. But obviously then, before he left, here was an opportunity to get some influence. This guy was going to he owes Joseph something for interpreting this dream. And so he pleads with the dude, when you get out, please have some pity on me. And when you're back in his favor, in Pharaoh's favor, mention me to Pharaoh and ask him to let me out of here. He goes on to explain, I've done nothing wrong this whole time. And, you know, the slavery I was put in was unjustified. Prison, all I did was the right thing. And I've been in prison for that. Help! Well, we read Pharaoh's cupbearer, however, promptly forgot all about Joseph, never giving him a second thought. Many years have gone on by now. Joseph was 17. Right at this point, he's about 32 years old. Or 30 years old right now. Think how long that is. Oh, man. And it's just been absolute disaster. His life has been a complete disaster up to this point. We read that 2 more years passed. Oh, I can just see Joseph in there oh God, thanks for bringing that cupbearer here. I know I'm going to get pulled some strings through him and get out of here. Month goes by, 2 months, a year. Oh my God, 2 whole years. Can you imagine the discouragement, the just bafflement of Joseph at this point? I would think this would really be the point of despair. It's just like, my life is a waste, you know, confusion. Also, unbelief. God, I've been praying to you this whole time. Why am I in this situation? Because I didn't want to disgrace your will, because I wanted to follow your will. Now look where I am. And all of this time, now he's 32 years old. Since from 17 to 32 has just been captivity and unhappiness for Joseph. And I would think that you could become embittered. Oh, goddamn brothers, idiots, selling me as a cow or something like that. Boy, this must have been rough. I just can't believe he said, but he still hangs in there and won't give up. And so after 2 years, Pharaoh's dream, he has a dream that he's standing on the bank of the Nile. As he's standing there, 7 fat cows come up out of the Nile and stand on the shore. Then 7 skinny cows come up out of the Nile, and the skinny cows start to eat the fat cows, and they eat them up. This dream really bothered Pharaoh. He thinks there's something to this. It's telling me something. I don't know what it is. He brings the wise man in, the holy man, the religious priests and everything. What does this dream mean? Nobody can figure it out. So all of a sudden, the king's cupbearer spoke up. Today I've been reminded of my failure, he said. He says, you know, when we were down in prison, there was this guy there that interpreted dreams. He interpreted my dream, and it came true, just like he said. Well, immediately, Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was brought hastily from the dungeon. After a quick shave and a change of clothes, he went in and stood in Pharaoh's presence. Okay, this shave isn't just the beard. This would be the head. The Egyptians had a real hang-up. They didn't like hair. And so they like the bald look. And he's basically being made like an Egyptian here. So he's shaven head, the eye makeup, and an Egyptian-type gown's put on. He's brought in and respectable before Pharaoh. That becomes important later in the story. Pharaoh says, well, I had a dream last night. He told him, none of these men can tell me what it means, but I've heard that you can interpret dreams. That's why I've brought you out. Joseph says, actually, no, I can't. It's not in my power to do this. But God will give you what it means, and he will set you at ease. Isn't that interesting? So after all this, he's still refusing to take glory, putting all glory to God. Still faithful to God. So amazing. So Potiphar told him the dream. He interprets it. He says the 7 fat cows are going to be 7 years of plenty. We're going to have bountiful harvests here in Egypt and more than we can eat. And then following that, there's going to be 7 years of famine that will completely eradicate whatever was saved up during the 7 years and so on. Pharaoh's sitting there. He's like, you know, I think that might be it. I think he's got something here. So now he says, what do you think we should do about it? He says, well, you should get yourself a dude, a leader, set up a program, build some granaries, charge a tax on everybody's crops. 20% goes into the granaries, and save this stuff up for 7 years. You're going to have so much grain, it's going to be busting out all over the place. Then when the famine starts, you'll have plenty of grain saved up, and people can come and get the grain, buy the grain, and you'll make some coin, and the country won't get messed up. They're like, dude, that's it, yeah, good plan. And then he discussed who should be appointed for the job. Pharaoh said, who could do it better than Joseph? He's a man that's obviously filled with the Spirit of God. He turns to Joseph and says, since God has revealed the meaning of the dreams to you, you're the wisest man in the land. I hereby appoint you to direct this whole project. You're going to be our director. of the grain project. You'll manage my household and organize all my people. Only I will have a higher rank than yours. He's now number two man in the Empire of Egypt. Whoa, rapid. From a dungeon to this, one day, boom. Big change. Didn't see that coming. Ah, man. Well, he proceeds to do what he had said they should do, and that's going on. Meanwhile, we go, and the camera shifts back up to Israel again, his family. They went through the years of plenty, so another 7 years have passed. All of a sudden, the years of famine hit in Egypt, but it also hit nearby Israel, was in famine as well. The rains just weren't coming. And so they're running out of food. And when Jacob heard that there was grain available in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you standing around looking at one another? I've heard there's grain down in Egypt. Go down and buy some for us before we all starve to death." And so Joseph and his 10 older brothers went down to Egypt to buy grain. Jacob wouldn't let his youngest son, Benjamin, go with them, however, for fear something might happen to him. The other favorite son, the other son of Rachel, that they probably are jealous about him, just like they were with Joseph. And Jacob by now knows these guys are no good. He won't trust them with that younger son. So they go ambling down to Egypt to buy grain. Since Joseph was the governor of all Egypt and in charge of the sale of the grain, it was to him that his brothers came. They bowed low before him with their faces to the ground. Oh, well, well, well. Guess that's exactly what that dream predicted would happen, isn't it? Here we are. But here's the interesting thing about it. Now, 22 years total, because there's seven and they're 2 years into the famine at this point. It adds up all the way to 20, 39 or 40 years old by now. When they saw him last, he was a kid, 17. He don't look anything. Now he's shaved, got the Egyptian eye swirls that they put on. He recognized them instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger. His brothers did not recognize him. But Joseph, well, isn't this interesting? So they're standing right there, and it's them. It's the guys that screwed him. He knows who they are. They have no idea who he is. Very intriguing situation right here. He says, "You guys are spies, aren't you? You come in and you're spying out the land. You're probably in here for pretending to be farmers, but you got an army waiting out in the deserts there." They're like, no, we just came to buy food. And he says, "Now you're spies," and throws them all in jail. Now he sits around thinking about it, brooding about it. For 3 days, they're in prison. Finally, he's got his plan, okay? He's going to put him to the test. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Okay, I'm a God-fearing man. If you do as I say, you'll live. We'll see how honorable you really are. Only one of you will remain in prison. The rest of you can go home with the grain for your families." Okay, and that, yeah, this hasn't come up yet, but we find out later. See, the reason they still don't recognize it as Joseph, he's not speaking to them in Hebrew. He speaks in Egyptian and has a translator give it to them in Hebrew. So as far as they know, he doesn't even know. That would give him away, maybe, if he showed that he knew Hebrew, but he definitely does know it. He says, "Yeah, so I'm going to let the rest of you go. I'm going to," I'm just going to keep one hostage here. "And you're going to go up, and then you're going to bring your youngest brother that you referred to back here. In this way, I'll know whether or not you're telling me the truth. If you are, I'll spare you." And they were all like, "Oh, okay. Packs them up. Speaking among themselves, they said, "This has all happened to us because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his terror, the anguish, and heard his pleadings, but we wouldn't listen. That's why these troubles come upon us." "Didn't I tell you not to do it?" Reuben says. "But you wouldn't listen. And now we're going to die because we murdered him." Of course, they think he's probably dead by now. Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them. He knew Hebrew. They assumed they're speaking in their own language. And he had been speaking to them through an interpreter, so they feel they can speak freely in Hebrew and he won't know what they're saying. Well, he left the room, goes running out, and found a place in the palace where he could weep. You can imagine how emotional this must have been, listening to these guys that betrayed him. And, oh man, this story has such incredible pathos. Then he finally gets it together. He comes walking back in and he picks out Simeon, one of the brothers that's going to be the hostage. And he has him tied up right in front of them. So they graphically see him led away as a prisoner. Now get out of here. Joseph then went to his servants and said, fill the men's sacks with grain, but also gave secret instructions to return each brother's payment at the top of his sack. So it's probably a little pouch of coins. And they're going to stick that in the grain and tie up the bags. Here's your grain. And then he gave them some food for their journey too. Probably some meat. So they loaded up their donkeys with the grain and they started for home. When they stopped for the night, one of them opened a sack to get out some grain to feed the donkeys. He finds his money in the sack. Good Lord, what's this doing in here? Look, he exclaimed to his brothers, my money's here in my sack. They were filled with terror and said to each other, now what's God done? Of course, they all find their money back in their sack. They're like, this isn't good. This is a setup. We're getting set up. Any minute the chariots are going to show up out here. They're going to take us down. But nothing happens. They wind up getting all the way back home. They tell Jacob what happened. Jacob is incredibly upset. This, you know, another son gone. And now they're saying, you got to send Benjamin back up there. Oh, he says, you idiots have deprived me of my children. Joseph has disappeared. Simeon's gone. Now you want to take Benjamin too. Everything's going against me. And so what we find here in Jacob's words, four claims. Joseph has disappeared. Not really. He's actually ruling the nation of Egypt right now and about to make some big moves. Simeon is gone. No, he's just a hostage. He's coming back. And now you want to take Benjamin. We're going to lose Benjamin. We're not going to lose Benjamin. Everything's going against me. Actually, everything's going for him. What we have here is what the author of Hebrews calls the scene. Remember you have that theme, the seen and the unseen. Here's the scene. Everything is going against me. All loss, all disaster. Actually, no, God's at work. There is no disaster here at all. Okay, well, there was no relief from the terrible famine throughout the land. So they eventually used up their grain. The grain which they brought from Egypt was almost gone. Jacob said to his sons, go down and buy us some more food from Egypt. Judah, the oldest, said, the man wasn't joking when he warned us we could not see him again unless Benjamin came along. He's like, if you let him come with us, we'll go down and buy more grain. But if you don't let him go, we may as well stay at home. Because remember, the man said, you won't see me. You won't be allowed even to come in and see me unless your brother is with you. Jacob is just can't stand that thought. This is his most beloved son. He's like, I know he's gonna get wasted. They sit longer. Eventually the grain is really out. They basically have no choice anymore. And he cries out, may God Almighty give you mercy as you go before this man, this bald dude, that he might release Simeon and return Benjamin. And if I have to bear the anguish of their deaths, then so be it. So they head out this time, and they've got Benjamin going along with them. They come in, led into the mean dude with the bald head. It's Joseph. He saw Benjamin was with him. He said to the manager of the household, these men are going to eat with me this noon. Take them inside and prepare a big feast. They were badly frightened when they saw how they were being taken, where they were being taken to this big palace. It's like, this isn't going to be good. He's messing with us. Oh. And they're like, oh, I know. He's plans. He's going to bring up about the money being in our sacks. And then he's going to pretend we stole it. Then he'll seize us, probably turn us into slaves, and he'll take our donkeys. That's it. The head of Egypt wants our donkeys. Oh, this is bad. Joseph ate by himself, and the brothers were served at a separate table. Interesting. The Egyptians sat at their own table because Egyptians despise Hebrews and refuse to eat with them. Remember that. That becomes important later on. So even though they're having a banquet, there's two separate tables. They won't sit at the same table with these guys. They don't like herdsmen. They don't like people that are hairy and have beards and stuff either. 44. When his brothers were ready to leave, Joseph gave these instructions. Fill each of their sacks. Put each man's money back in his sack again. And put my personal silver cup, a treasure, at the top of the youngest brother's sack, along with his grain money. So the household manager did what he was told. They load him up, load up the donkeys, head on out. Well, long about later that afternoon, they're trucking along with their donkeys, and here comes a bunch of riders up. It's Pharaoh's guard. Oh, how ungrateful you guys. He had a feast for you and everything, and then you dared to steal his silver goblet. They're like, that's BS. I said, if you can find his cup with any of us, let that one die. And all the rest of us will be your master's slaves forever. They're pretty confident. That's fair enough, the man replied, except that only the one who stole is going to be a slave. The rest of you can go free. Joseph's servant began to search the oldest brother's sack, going down the line to the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Well, isn't this interesting? So all they have to do, they're going to take Benjamin away in chains. He's going to be a slave. It's kind of a replay. This is kind of Joseph Deuce, isn't it? They can ride on home with their grain and their money returned and everything, and all I had to do is forfeit one of their brothers, who they were jealous of anyway. It's a test. Has anything changed? Have they learned anything? Yeah. They're like, we're all coming back. We're not going to go home. They come in before Joseph, and Judah cries out, oh, my Lord, what can we say to you? How can we plead? How can we prove our innocence? God's punishing us for our sins. My Lord, we have all returned to be your slaves. We and our brother, where the cup was in his sack. No, Joseph said, no, only the man who stole the cup will be my slave. The rest of you can go on home to your father. But Reuben says, please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy. Let him go and let you can have me as a slave. Let the boy return with his brothers. How can I return to my father if the boy's not with me? I can't bear to see what this would do to him. He's a changed man. Now he's sacrificial. Chapter 45. Joseph could stand it no longer. Out, all of you, he says to his Egyptian and the servant crowd there that are in there. Everybody leaves except for the brothers. He wanted to be alone with the brothers when he told them who he was. He broke down and wept aloud. I am Joseph, he said to his brothers. Is my father still well? They're just standing there like... you know, that would really take some time to absorb. Whoa. They don't believe it. It says they were brothers were speechless. They just were stunned to realize that Joseph was standing right there in front of them. Come over here, he said. So they came closer and he said again, I am Joseph, your brother who you sold into Egypt. It's true. Wow. Paradigm shift. Oh, this doesn't sound too good here either if you're one of those brothers. He's got the upper hand on us now. You know, we had it on him. Now he's got us dead to rights. What's he going to do? He says, don't be angry with yourselves that you did this to me, for God did it. Really, it wasn't you that did it. He sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. He's figured it out. He's figured the whole thing out in these years. These 2 years of famine are going to grow to 7, and during which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God has sent me here to keep you and your families alive so that you'll become a great nation. And so all the pieces start to congeal into a picture here. Yes, he says it was God who sent me here, not you. He has made me a counselor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire household, and a ruler over all Egypt. So all God never lost control of this situation. He's been in total control and guiding the situation all the way down. How Joseph knew that all those years, I have no idea. He trusted. He didn't know. He had to trust in the unseen. Hurry, return to my father. Tell him this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me master over all the land of Egypt. Come down to me right away. You'll live in the land of Goshen so you can be near me with all your children, grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all that you have. I'll take care of you there. For there's still 5 years of famine ahead of us. Otherwise, you and your household will become to utter poverty, possibly to starvation. And so they go up and bring down the entire clan, the women, the children. There's 70 people now in this family total. Pharaoh was happy for Joseph that he had his family back with him. He told him the whole story. He says, I got a good place for them. This land of Goshen is right in the delta of the Nile River. It's one of the most fertile places on earth. Every year inundated with fresh silt that makes it an outstanding place for agriculture of every kind. The Egyptians, remember how they would sit separate and it says they deplored Hebrews, they wouldn't have anything to do with them. Totally different than the Canaanites, where they came from. The Canaanites were eager to intermarry and to, you know, assimilate, and basically this irresistible polytheistic religion that was, you know, sexually orgiastic and had all of these crazy sex rites and everything, in which throughout their history, the Jews cannot resist getting entangled in this. And this was happening to that decline that we saw generation by generation until we come to this abysmal group of the 10 brothers. Benjamin, we really don't know anything about him, but you know, it's basically going to hell in a handbasket, and they're totally accommodating themselves to Canaan, to a corrupt culture. They're going to disappear probably within a generation. They're just going to be Canaanites. There'll be no difference. God is trying to incubate a people that will be distinct from other peoples, that will know his ways, record those things, set up the needed groundwork for his future plan that goes all the way down to Christ, the coming of Christ, and beyond, right down to here tonight, is also part of this plan that he's been working right throughout history. And so he's basically arranged to have them taken out of the scene in Canaan and brought down to this super luscious plot in Goshen, but the Egyptians are like, won't have anything to do with them. They're isolated, and that's where they incubate. They stay there in the years to follow, change from a family into a nation in the next 4 centuries that they live down in Egypt. At that point, God decides they're ready to go back to the promised land. Well, so this plan, now we have the unseen has become seen right here. And it turns out that God was faithful the whole way through. And yeah, think about Joseph when he was still living in the world where all of this was still unseen. Even that day before they summoned him to Pharaoh, he had no idea that anything good was ever going to happen. How many people would have flaked out? He could have flaked out. He could have jumped in bed with Potiphar's old lady or any number of other points, just have given up faith. But because he didn't, he made it to that day where they brought him up to Pharaoh and boom, shakalaka. So this is what this is all about. And he's hung in there until he got to see what God was really doing. And so there's really a deep, you know, lesson here for us too. A lot of times trusting God, you know, you can have sorrow, you can have trial, you can have even disaster in your life. And it's hard to understand sometimes. You know, God, I've been praying to you, why is this happening? You don't get to know unless you hang in there. And faith is what is the assurance of things unseen, as we read earlier. Eventually, we'll see. We'll see the unseen. But not if we flake out too early. We got to hang in there. And so back to Hebrews 11, he talks about how it was by faith that Joseph, when he was about to die, confidently spoke of God's bringing the people of Israel out to Egypt. He's got God talking to him. This move down here to Egypt is temporary. Eventually, you're going to wind up back in the promised land. And he was so sure that he commanded them to carry his bones with them when they left and bury them up in the promised land. Now, Joseph hadn't even lived there that long. You know, I mean, I don't know what it is. There certainly probably wasn't any sentimental attachment to that land. The attachment is the covenant with Abraham. Basically, what Joseph is saying here is that he knows that loyalty to our covenant with God is where it's at. And that's why I don't want to be left down in Egypt. I want to be transported. And they did. In Exodus, we read that when Moses led the people out, one of the things they brought was a box with the bones of Joseph in them. I saved them all those years. Took it back up and eventually buried it in the promised land. And so this showed that through all of this, Joseph had that covenant in mind. Jacob must have taught him about the covenant they had with God. And that's what he was believing and holding on to with faith the whole time through. Well, story of Joseph. I'm going to draw the line there for tonight. Yeah, God, you've called on me for a few things. Nothing like this. I'm thankful. Never had to put up with something like this. But it becomes hard. We do get confused, God. And you know what it's like to be weak because you came here. And we read that Jesus understands our weaknesses and is sympathetic to us. Yeah, I'm sure he must have been confused. And yet the incredible and beautiful thing is he stayed in there with you. We want to do that too, God, whatever you call us to, that we won't jump to conclusions, that we won't turn against you, that we will continue to trust. Not because we know where this is all headed, but because you are trustworthy. That's all we need to know. And we thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.